Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. What makes a strong, resilient city? Well, my guest today says that a compact, developed city that is walkable with infrastructure that's sustainable, strong transportation systems makes for an economically healthy city. My guest today is Charles Marone, Chuck Marone, a civil engineer, urban planner, and president of Strong Towns. Marone is the author of several books, including Thoughts on Building Strong Towns, A World-Class Transportation System, Transportation Finance for a New Economy, and a forthcoming book due out in February, Money Hall, Building Strong Cities in an Unfair Time. Strong Towns' mission is to support a model of growth for cities and towns that grow from the inside first, with strong transportation systems, walkability, and built on a healthy local economy. He'll be the keynote speaker for a free event, the Walk to the Future Sidewalk Summit, which will be coming up Tuesday, October 14th, which will bring together national and regional land use and urban design experts to discuss the connections between walkable environments and economic vitality. The event will take place at OU Tulsa, and it's free to the public, but requires pre-registration. You can learn more at TulsaSidewalkStories.com. Chuck Marone is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Chuck Marone, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
So let's just start very simple. What is a strong town in your mind?
A strong town is, first and foremost, a place that can take care of itself, a place that is financially resilient and is not dependent on others, particularly state and federal governments, for their basic ongoing maintenance needs. I worked for many years as an engineer, another bunch of years as a land use planner for cities. One of the things we saw all the time was that we could get money to build all kinds of things, but we couldn't figure out how to fill potholes and fix cracked sidewalks. And we had no money to do basic things. And that got me to kind of looking into why is that? And so the concept of a strong town, a place that actually puts those kind of things first and is able to do them just as a matter of course, is something that developed out of that insight.
That's a very common experience here in Tulsa, and I would think in a lot of American cities.
Oh, yeah.
Are there cities that are better at doing those sort of basic infrastructure maintenance items, and what's the thing they have going for them to be able to do that?
You know, there are places that go about it more competently than others, but what we're really talking about, what we've really seen is just systematically every city in the country is struggling with the same kind of thing. And that means it's not a kind of matter of competence or a matter of local approach, but it's really a nationwide problem. We all live today as cities in this world that has been defined by our post-World War II development pattern. During the Great Depression, right after World War II, we had a huge shift, not only in building around the automobile, but in the way we financed and went about creating growth and jobs and economic development. It's largely now a top-down kind of undertaking. And so, you know, at the federal level, at the state level, there's a lot of incentive to goose GDP. There's a lot of incentive to do big projects. There's not so much incentive to do maintenance. And a lot of that kind of thinking has been, over the decades, embedded into local government as well. There's kind of a saying that I've heard many times, it's easier to get $1 million than $10,000. And for local governments, it's really true. If you want to bite off a huge project and do something really big and transformative, there's programs to do that. They've got mechanisms to go about getting those things done. If you want to raise $10,000 to fix the sidewalks up the street, that comes from a completely different pool of money, and there's a lot more resistance there, and it's a lot more difficult to do. We need to readjust those systems so that they're modernized, because a lot of this was designed to build all this stuff the first time, and we need to change them so we have more of an emphasis on how do we maintain, how do we keep what we have, and at the end of the day, how do we make better use of it?
In a lot of ways, I think a lot of this is about what is the cheapest way to develop, and for a good part of the era after World War II, it was far easier to build out than to rebuild within. Have we reached that tipping point now where it's easier to rebuild within than to keep building further out? And I assume that's one of your points about being able to service your infrastructure is the fact that certainly most auto-dominated cities are really spread out and there's a lot of mileage.
That's absolutely correct, although I would kind of put a little caveat on it, it wasn't necessarily cheaper to build out. But what building out did is it allowed local governments to tap into a different money stream than one that was created locally. And what cities did in those transactions is they took on these enormous long-term liabilities to maintain everything. When the federal government comes in with a grant, or the state comes in with a subsidy, or the Department of Transportation comes in with a project, or when a developer comes in and says, I'll build this residential subdivision or these commercial properties, cities generally don't pay very much of that transaction. There might be a little match, there might be a little bit of staff time we have to kick in, but our cost as local governments is pretty nominal. All of a sudden, we have all this new tax base, though, and all this new growth, and that makes us feel really wealthy. It gives us a lot of revenue. The problem is we take on the long-term responsibility of fixing and maintaining and servicing all those miles of curb and sidewalk and streets and roads and pipes and pumps. All that stuff becomes our responsibility. We live today in the future, of the people who did this a generation ago. A future that they didn't really consider. And we find ourselves with these enormous long-term obligations, but not enough tax base to meet those. We've actually not generated enough wealth to have the money to go back and fix all this stuff.
I think that's one of the common themes you see as suburbanization takes hold is the, at first there's a downtown, and then there is the immediate ring around the downtown, and then there's another ring beyond that. And once those rings begin building, the rings closest to downtown a lot of times have deteriorated. And in older cities, you had this industrial ring outside of the town. That's all failed, and all that housing. And so all of that tax wealth has been lost, really.
It's very true. Suburban development has a very kind of predictable and in retrospect now, very understandable pattern to it. There's a period of very quick and rapid growth. We call this the illusion of wealth phase because cities that go through this feel very, very rich. I'm sure in the Tulsa area you can see cities out on the edge that are, building the big facilities and have all the money and seem like they're the place to be. The places, a ring or two in were that same thing a generation ago. Once you go through this growth phase, there's a period of stagnation kind of hanging on, and then you hit the rapid decline phase. And it's not a byproduct of, again, government competence. It's not a byproduct of the people who have chosen to live in these places. It's a byproduct of just the fact that when you build everything all at once, it goes bad all at once. And when you can build it the way we finance things today, you really don't have the pressure to upfront make sure that the thing's going to last for a long time.
And I think the thing that people sort of forget is, once those ring of developments emerge, eventually you outstrip your borders. And then all of a sudden the tax base is going to surrounding communities, yet you still have the cost of the infrastructure to connect those outside entities with your community. You're still running water lines. You're still running roads. You're still doing maintenance on roads and all of the infrastructure where that new tax money is outside of the city's borders.
That's really true. That is true. Although I will say the cities that have actually been the most constricted actually are quite often in the healthiest position today because what they haven't done is kind of chased everything on the periphery. The further out you go, the higher the cost is and the lower the return is, or actually the more negative the return is.
So are you saying like the cities that sort of set their borders pretty early and didn't try to capture the outside growth today are in a better position than, say, a city that basically expanded their borders to capture all that growth?
By far. And generally it wasn't a conscious decision. It was a decision kind of forced on them by geography.
Right.
You look at a city like Detroit or a city like Memphis, which had no boundaries at all and could just continue to grow out into the hinterland. These places are enormous size-wise, and they have incredible liabilities. When you get out 2, 3, 4 miles from the core of what the original cities were, the amount of tax base that you have versus the miles of road and pipe and liabilities, it is so far underwater. It's just a matter of time before these places are completely insolvent.
Well, I was just in Memphis a few months ago, and I can tell you that you don't even have to go out a few miles.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, and Memphis has a beltway I want to say 3 or 4 miles out, and then I have another one that's like 10 miles out.
Yeah.
This is lunacy. And you know, you look at a place like Detroit where people say, well, the problem in Detroit is that the population is lost, there's not enough people, there's so much area. Memphis has two-thirds of the population of Detroit, and I want to say 3 times the area. It is a huge mess. Yeah, the cities that had their borders kind of artificially constrained by either other cities around there or a lack of desire to go out further find themselves in a much stronger position today, even though it didn't maybe look that way over the last few decades.
My guest today is Chuck Marone, a civil engineer and president of Strong Towns. He'll be the keynote speaker for NCOG's Walk to the Future Sidewalk Summit. Be coming up next week, Tuesday, October 14th at OU Tulsa. And a big part of Strong Towns is sort of developing these cities that are walkable, that are sustainable. There's all sorts of things. Like in our city, we're ambitiously building sidewalks, but the sidewalks are fairly small. And it's if you ever actually had volume on the sidewalks, they wouldn't even work.
Right.
But I digress a bit. I want to ask a question about you as sort of your sort of conversion, because you, as a civil engineer, you've admitted that you designed and developed what are, in hindsight, you refer to as terribly unproductive places. So what led you to the idea that suburbanization and building places around the automobile was misguided? What led to your conversion?
Well, I grew up in a small town, and when I got out of school, I was interested in building a great America. And I really thought that the stuff that I was building, the way I was going about it, was going to make this country great and strong. It wasn't until I really got into the numbers and started adding up what things cost and then started looking at the tax base that was there saying, wait a sec, this doesn't make any sense. We're putting millions of dollars of infrastructure in, and the infrastructure in the street is actually worth, in some cases, more than the homes and the development that it serves. How is the tax base off of this supposed to sustain these public investments? I think the most bizarre one for me was kind of towards the end of my engineering days when I left and went back to grad school then to get a planning degree. We actually went through and did an assessment project in a trailer park, and we were asking these trailer owners to pay $15,000, $17,000, $20,000 for their sewer, water, and street improvements. And I was looking at these places going, these are not even worth $20,000, and they're depreciating in value. This is grossly unfair. Why are we doing this? And the reason is because it was part of the plan. It was the approach that you take, and this is the way we go about doing things. No one had ever done the numbers. And the revelation to me was that we figure out as engineers, we figure out as city officials how to get projects done. But nobody ever steps back and says, financially, is this a worthy project? Is this something that actually makes sense for the taxpayer?
So what does a strong town look like in your idea, in your mind?
I'm going to say, I'll give you an example, acknowledging that it's not a perfect example. But this is kind of where my thinking has evolved over the years. If you go back prior to the Great Depression, and look at cities the way they were built at that point in time, they were very strong and resilient. And one of the ways we know that is if they weren't, they simply went away. There was nothing supporting them from the outside. So one of the things that we've done is take a look at that development pattern and say, what were these people doing that led their places to be so financially strong and resilient? A lot of it was that the development pattern was based around people who walked. The building styles, the building types, the way buildings interrelate with each other, the way that significant structures are placed at the end of the street to reflect value to those around them. There's all these little tricks that were developed literally over thousands of years that these people understood about how to build great cities that would last during times that were good, during times that were difficult. We're not going back to that, and we're not going to have the horse and buggy, and we're not going to, get to different cities by train. We have the automobile, and the automobile is a great invention. I think that our challenge is to look back at the things that worked, that accumulated wisdom, and say, how can we inject some of that into what we're currently doing so that we can start to stitch these places back together?
I want to follow up on something you said, which I think when we're talking a lot about smart growth and walkable spaces, I think there's a, sometimes it's a subtext, sometimes it's overt, that the automobile is going to go away. And that, even in the largest, best run cities that have incredible transportation systems with buses popping by every 5 minutes, a great rail system that takes hundreds of, and maybe millions of people to their destinations, there's still a need for automobiles. And I think sometimes I sense that a lot of people, they just don't think through the idea that the automobile is still going to be there and it's still going to be a part of the landscape.
Yeah, I'm reflexively, you know, not anti-automobile. I think this is an invention that has created a whole lot of good for this country, really transformed markets, opened up different markets to different people, and has created a lot of opportunity. The problem that we have in the United States, and I think people who have the planning profession is guilty of always talking about how wonderful Europe is, but I think anybody who's gone to a European city has seen likely a design where the automobile is not the dominant force in the public realm, where the public space is actually designed for people and then accommodates automobiles kind of as a secondary way. In the U.S., the mistake that we made was that not only do we connect cities for automobiles, which is brilliant, but we said we're going to re-engineer all of our cities to be auto-dominated so that any other type of use, be it just walking and biking or be it some type of transit, is going to be not just a secondary use, but way, way, way down the list of priorities. That's a really expensive approach, and it's one that has really limited people's options, especially today as the economy is transforming and changing. The automobile is not going away, but we just need to have a healthier design relationship with it.
So does that mean you've talked about going back to a pre-depression sort of look at how a city operates? Does that mean streetcars on every corner, or what does that exactly mean? Because there's a lots of things that won't return. For example, those pre-depression cities had this downtown, and then right surrounding it, you had a whole ring of factories and worker housing.
Yeah.
And it was creating tremendous pollution.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the great victories of the early planning profession was that separation of uses.
Yeah.
The idea that we shouldn't have a smoky factory next to a housing because that was not good for anybody. The problem is that, you know, once you get that one victory, then the planning departments kind of went nuts. And now we have big houses can't be next to small houses, can't be next to apartment houses. If you have two families living in one house, that has to be, you know, separated from places where you have one family living in a house. We've taken a good idea to an extreme. We're not going to go back, and I don't think I don't think any desire to go back necessarily to just that living style. But if we were going to pull out one insight that they intuitively understood that we've completely lost today, it is this notion that we should be building things incrementally. Today, we're all about the big transformative project. We're all about the big transformative investment. They were much more prudent about how they approach things. And I'll just give you one example. When my wife and I got married in 1995, we went and we built a house. All the advice we got at the time was build it big. If you're going to have some kids, you want to put 3-4 bedrooms into this. You want to have a bunch of bathrooms. That's going to be good for resale value. We went out and got a lot. We built a 2,500 square foot house, and the two of us lived there in what really comparatively was a mansion. It was just huge with all this space that we never used. You look at the way my grandparents built their first house. They went out and built a tiny little thing with the money that they had, and then when their first kid was born, they did a little addition on the side, and then when the second kid was born, they put a second floor on, and they built it in a much more prudent, kind of scale to them, less risky approach. They never had the huge mortgage we had. Take that kind of insight now and apply it to the city as a whole, and you really start to understand what a group of people who weren't wealthy and didn't have access to money they could just throw around, they had to be really resourceful and resilient, and they couldn't afford to make huge mistakes. So they worked in small scale. We need to do that again. That would be a huge transformation for our cities.
Now, that's the subject of your forthcoming book next February, Money Hall, which is a play on Moneyball, the Billy Bean, which, you know, get the most value for marginal players. And you said cities sort of have to do the same thing.
Yeah. And to me, when I read the book Moneyball and then I watched the movie, I was shouting at the screen going, this is exactly what I'm trying to say. Cities today have this fetish with the large, big transformative project. The same way that baseball GMs would love to get the big, splashy free agent. But what Billy Bean showed us in baseball is that it's sometimes these guys that the standard scouts say are washed up and defective in some way that are actually the really productive players. They produce really well. One of the things that we found studying cities and actually asking some of these return on investment questions is that things like crosswalks and planting trees and putting in bike lanes and fixing sidewalks, they're really low-cost things, and we tend to devalue them. Yet when you look at the return on those investments, the actual dollars of tax base and wealth that you get in return for those kind of investments, they're off the charts. They're enormous. We go and spend millions and millions of dollars running infrastructure all over the place, and we get back very small amounts of that. We start to do projects like planting trees and putting in crosswalks and just taking care of things, and the returns on those investments are enormous. They're huge and transformative.
And when you say return on investments, you're saying instead of the city investing in, say, a redevelopment, once you have all this beautification eye candy, that's going to make it attractive to private money, right?
Exactly. Although I wouldn't even call it beautification in the sense that, you know, one of the things that we've done here in my hometown is gone out and said, all right, what are some of the urgent investments that are needed in these neighborhoods? And we worked in one neighborhood for a summer. And what we found is that people were just struggling. They were struggling to walk to the grocery store. It wasn't safe. They were struggling to get around the neighborhood. The parks weren't well kept up. We're just talking about basic maintenance stuff. You know, let's put in a crosswalk here where there's lots of people crossing the street and it's kind of dangerous. You know, we're not saying go out and put up decorative lights everywhere and, you know, nice brick sidewalks and make it look good. We're talking in a lot of places, just make it functional. These are tiny investments. And literally, when we can make a neighborhood more comfortable and easy to live in, we will attract people to want to live in those places. And yeah, the private investment will make those small little public investments pay off fivefold, tenfold, fiftyfold.
One of the things I was really interested in when looking at the Strong Towns organization is that it's really grassroots, and it's about getting not specialists to talk about what the solutions are. It's average citizens. And one of the things you're doing is these strong citizen challenges. And you mentioned walking to a grocery store. That's one of your challenges, is to, in your community, take a walk to get groceries. Now, I know in our city, that's a daunting task. There are people who do it, who have to do it.
Right.
But for most of our citizens, that it would be unpleasant and arduous task, I would say.
Yeah, well, think that one through for a sec, because if you cannot walk to the grocery store, you're in a really fragile place. And that's one of the points of the Strong Citizen Challenge, is to help people kind of evaluate their own choices and their own living place, because we're not going to have strong cities if we don't have strong citizens living in them. And if you're living in a way that makes you really vulnerable to things like the cost of gasoline, for example, or your ability to get an auto loan, you know, or your ability to pay for a new engine in your car if your car goes out. You are in a really, really fragile place. One of the things we realized early on, and this was my own shortcomings, you know, I started out trying to talk to the people I knew. I was trying to convince engineers to do things differently and planners to do things differently and public officials to do things differently. And it took me a while to grasp that what we really need are citizens carrying this message forward. And the real answer, and the cities we saw being most effective in making these changes, were the ones where they had really active citizens who understood the problem, were taking ownership of their own communities, and were communicating these messages in their own language with their own people. So, yeah, the Strong Citizen Challenge is meant to kind of galvanize that kind of person. We call them the Georges after this guy that we identified as being kind of the most effective at this. Galvanize these Georges all over the country to go and make the changes in their own communities. We can do this. We just have to think a little bit differently about our places.
My guest today is Charles Marone, a civil engineer and president of Strong Towns, who will be the keynote speaker for NCOG's Walk to the Future Sidewalk Summit, which will be held Tuesday, October 14th at OU Tulsa. It's free to the public, but pre-registration is strongly encouraged, and Charles Marone is our guest today. One of the things you said, one of the main determinants of future prosperity for cities will be the local leaders' ability to transform their communities. And when I look around the country, and not only nearby, but all around the country, you see a lot of leaders, local leaders, giving lip service to the idea of smart growth, urbanization, healthy downtowns, and the like. But it's almost like there's not a complete buy-in.
Right.
And a lot of times it's sort of, it's not the whole nine yards. It's a little bit here and a little bit there and hedging their bets. So if that is true, the main determinant of future prosperity, what does that say for our cities?
Our cities need to change dramatically. And the leadership approach of our cities is actually one of the things that drastically needs to change. We are set up for a variety of reasons that were logical at the time. We're set up with an orientation that is upward, not downward, at the local government level. We take our cues from the states. We take our cues from the federal government. Our bureaucracies are set up in this kind of hierarchical fashion, basically to facilitate the goals and the objectives of these kind of higher levels of government. If we turn around and have a different relationship, one that focuses on our people and our neighborhoods, and one that actually takes our cues from our people living in our neighborhoods, we have a much different form of government. This is really difficult because it requires local officials to give up power and give up control and embrace what we call the chaotic but smart kind of approach, an approach that is based on small incremental investments, some of which may work, some of which may not work. But the idea is you learn from your mistakes quickly enough to change them. And do something different. This is a much different style of government than we have today and than we tend to idealize in the strong leader kind of model. We really need to turn our cities back over to our people. And if we do that, it's going to be a little bit messier, but at the end of the day, we're going to get results that are a lot better, not only a lot better for us financially, but a lot better for us as people.
Charles Marone? Thanks very much for your time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be there in Tulsa.
Charles Marone is a civil engineer and the president of Strong Towns. You can learn more about their organization at strongtowns.org. And he'll be the keynote speaker for the Walk to the Future Sidewalk Summit to be held Tuesday, October 14th at OU Tulsa. The event is free but requires pre-registration. You can learn more at tulsasidewalkstories.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.